Okay, I'm just going to get started since we don't have a huge amount of time, and I'm going to keep this really brief. I had other prepared remarks, but we're already 10 minutes late, so I will do a quick intro, and then we'll turn it over to our four esteemed panelists. Hi, everyone. My name is Danielle Ryu. I am the Associate Director of the Human Rights Project here at BARD, and I am the founder of Human Rights Radio and a member of the Experimental Humanities Sound Cluster. So I'm really excited to be able to introduce our theme today, which is transmission, and to introduce all of the four presenters today and to moderate the discussion that follows, which I think will be brief because of time, but rich in content, hopefully. So like I said, this that's up to you, Olga. Transmission highlights the way that sound is conveyed through a variety of different media. To consider transmission, we need to address the nature of... Sorry? Can everybody hear me in the back? Okay, sorry. Transmission highlights the way sound is conveyed through a variety of media. To consider transmission, we need to address the nature of the medium or format, its communicative limitations and potentials, and the social protocols for its use, as well as how sound travels through it. Transmission, literally meaning to send across, often carries with it a strong spatial connotation. Communications, satellites, undersea cables, switchboards tie together humans and non-humans, in global techno-social networks, though of varying speed, cost, and saturation depending on where you live in the world. A web of transnational and bilateral agreements and national regulatory frameworks condition how and where these networks operate, what architect and theorist Keller Easterling terms extra statecraft in her 2014 book of the same title, the systems of decision-making and authority that govern the ways that infrastructure evolves and becomes integrated into and along with societies. At the same time, this technological understanding of transmission is often projected onto communication at large, reducing the multiple modes of transmission into a generalized notion of a neutral process. In other words, we often think of transmission as a simple or direct process by which something is carried from one point to another. Transduction, the carrying of a signal, the changing of the signal, the reconstituting of the signal on the receiving end. The speakers in this panel will present ideas to complicate this notion of neutrality and will highlight the ways in which transmission can suggest a number of meanings and processes at once. So I'm going to skip all of the other stuff I was going to say, and then which was really interesting. All written out. I will just move on directly to introduce our first panelist, and maybe I'll introduce and then present, and then I'll introduce and present just to remind everybody who everybody is up here. So our first presenter is our very own Professor Drew Thompson, who's an assistant professor of historical and Africana studies here at BARD. His research considers the ways in which photography as practice and discourse impacts the construction and operation of bureaucracy in colonial and post-independent Mozambique. As an extension of this study, he teaches classes on the history of the radio in Africa, urbanism, historical photography, liberation struggles, and post-colonial theory. At BARD, he's been involved in efforts to integrate new technologies like podcasts and online exhibitions in the teaching of history, and he's also been actively involved in the programmatic efforts of Africana Studies in terms of organizing lecture series and various other kinds of initiatives here on campus. He received a PhD in African history from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and his BA is in history of art and art history from Williams College. Join me in welcoming Drew Thompson.
So I should say that I come at this topic of sound and sonic as a visual historian, not as a sound studies expert. And I'm also, after the keynote speeches from last night, both by Professor Thompson and Jonathan Stern, I was also kind of hesitant in using this word transmission because of its somewhat loudness. In speaking about the visual, it somewhat asserts a type of absolute for the visual that everyone can perfectly see and everyone can perfectly hear. And so in many ways, my remarks today seek to challenge that notion of the relationship between the visual and the sonic in order to better understand perhaps conditions of colonialism and independence in Mozambique. So to begin, to orient ourselves, I first want to give you a geographic map of Mozambique, which is here, which was the site of a war between Portugal and the Liberation Front Frelimo between 1963 and 1974. This war was over territorial control and the sovereignty of Mozambique, which at the time was a province of the Portuguese Empire. It should also be noted that Mozambique in many ways was part of a larger geography of Portuguese colonial rule, which also included Angola, Sao Tome, Guinea-Bissau, and also Cape Verde over here. And what is interesting at some level is, I think, that Mozambique in many ways for Portugal was the colony that was farthest away, but at the same time, the radio played a critical role in the way in which the Portuguese Empire situated Mozambique, and I'll show you at two levels. At one level, the Portuguese administrators over the course of the war were constantly engaged with reading and listening to messages of the radio, but they used the radio to situate, if we think about it, is that Ghana, Egypt, and also Tanzania achieved their independence long before and were important socialist allies. And in many ways, to take the language of the radio, the Portuguese sort of listened into radio broadcasts that were happening from these three nations to sort of situate threats to its rule at that time period. So the radio became a way of listening in, but also situating its liberation struggle within a Cold War context. And my work as a visual historian, as Daniel was mentioning, has been thinking about the ways in which photography constitutes bureaucracy, but it also seems that the sonic allows a way to locate or situate that visual without even having to see or look at photographs. So in the remainder of the time of my remarks, I want to sort of give you a sense of what these archival documents look like as the way that the sonic and visual translate through them. And then ending by thinking about what happens in Mozambique's liberation war. So if we talk, start and situate it, what is so fascinating to me is that in 1963, and we have a document from the diplomatic archives, that the Portuguese are talking about the radio. They are listening in, so to speak, to Radio Moscow, they're listening to Radio Tanzania, they're listening to Radio Algiers, and they are noticing the ways in which certain messages are being broadcast across southern Africa. In 1966, you also have documents where officials are very concerned with the technical assistance that Russians are providing to these liberation struggles in southern Africa, specifically with the training of the radio and the technicians who would operate these radio broadcasts. And there's something about 66, 67 when the Portuguese finally make an argument for why they should build the necessary infrastructures by which to then carry out their own broadcasting. What is also interesting, and I should note, is that many of these documents have different labels and message streams which one could follow. And my contention is that the visual, the photographic, which is not present here, shapes the conditions under which different bureaucrats come in contact with the information that the sonic is supposed to provide. So confidential and secret meant that different levels of the bureaucracy were sort of, again, tuning in or using the sonic or visual to sort of locate the decision-making processes that they were made to do. So if we go to 1967, and if we locate that in 67 in a larger history of Frelimo's liberation struggle, a year later, Frelimo, which is a liberation movement that was also fighting against the Portuguese, its first president would be killed, Eduardo Mondlane, in an assassination attempt. And what is fascinating to me is that in 67, the Portuguese really are positioning the visual, their notion of the visual with the sonic, and you can see it here in some of their administrative documents. sorry about the clarity, but in Portuguese, in the first half, they're talking about their press representation, the images that should be in the press at the time, at the specific moment in 67. And then they're also speaking here about the radio broadcast, what kind of content and what radio broadcasting should happen. And I think it's striking here about how the visual and the radio come together in many ways that would set a foundation for which the Portuguese would launch its war. And if we go forward in time to 72, the nature of the documents, what I would call the aesthetic qualities of these documents in which information is then being, and I was trying to prevent myself from using this word, but I will use it, it's quite striking, is that you no longer have people writing down what they're seeing and hearing. You have them actually creating documents that structure how messages are translated and passed over time. And what is interesting is that they list their targeted group, the objectives, the themes, the messages, and then schedules for it. So what you often see here is that the Portuguese were very skeptical of the power of the visual. They did not believe that a photograph was worth 1,000 words. They were actually very quite paranoid. So they also supplemented oftentimes the visual with the sonic. At some points, what you can notice is that they would circulate by air, and that's why the first map was somewhat important about where the military bases were. Those airplanes that were doing surveillance would drop the posters or the photographs onto certain areas that were considered occupied. And then they would come back either 2 weeks later and circulate sounds, or they would do the sounds as they were dropping them. And so oftentimes these messages included Mozambique and Portugal are the same, we are together, or they would send racialized messages, is that blacks and whites are equal, and they would show a sign that showed Mozambique and Portugal as one nation. And in many ways, despite the irony of it, it is interesting about the entangledness or the interdependence of how the visual and the sonic come together, and oftentimes how radio broadcasting was used to somewhat supplement that, to do sometimes what the visual could not do. I also just wanted to give you a sense of, I've also become interested in the ways in which the radio became photographed, or the ways in which we think about the sonic as informing the visual contents of different photographs. And so the first one that I wanted to show you is here, which is a form of Portuguese propaganda, which has mentioning of the helicopter, right? So there is an evocation of the sonic in some of these forms of propaganda, just as the sonic is informing the visual content of what we see. And then in the slides over onto your right, my left, is also scenes in which Portuguese military, both ironically in 68 and 73, are seen next to their radios. And I think this is fascinating, is because radio is not only integrated into the lives of the bureaucratic apparatus in which is informing them of their activities, but it's something that they sit next to, they touch. And I think that becomes really quite fascinating for the thinking about the multitude of ways in which information is both traveling and its implications. So just to, by way of conclusion, one thing that I thought to think about is that in 1974, Portugal, in April 1974, is the Carnation Revolution. The fascist regime is toppled by a revolt. It is not clear to the Caetano government what will happen to its colonial holdings. But at the same time in Mozambique, an opposition group takes form, and it takes form around the very radio and sonic structures that the Portuguese had built to defend their colonies. And these settler groups were not necessarily arguing for Mozambique's independence. They were arguing for independence from Portugal, but for white settler rule in Mozambique. And what is striking is that in Maputo, Lourenço Marques and Beira at the time, these settler groups occupy the radio stations. And at the same time, this photograph is by the famed photographer Ricardo Rangel, who himself used photography to unseat colonial rule. And I just use these images to show both the entangleness in which the visual and sonic have within this context, but also to rethink the condition of colonialism and independence that is now created by that. It's not necessarily a seamless tradition, because as we would know, that the sonic and visual would carry over into the post-independent state in which it would have to both listen to and address. So thank you.
Thanks, Drew. All right, so our second presenter is coming to us from St. Petersburg, Russia, a colleague of ours at our partner institution there at Smolny College, on the Faculty of Liberal Arts of Smolny College at St. Petersburg University. Masha Godovanya is a visual artist, curator, and educator born in Moscow. She holds an MFA in film and video arts from Bard. And she's an alumna of the MFA program here. And she's now enrolled, you've finished the MA program, though, in political sciences.
Yes.
And sociology at the European University of St. Petersburg. Masha's film and visual work have been shown at many international film festivals, screenings, galleries, and biennials, such as Manifesta 10 in Russia, the 7th Liverpool Biennial, Centre Georges Pompidou, France, and the Rotterdam Film Festival, Oberhausen International Film Festival, the London Film Festival, and many others. I'm going to stop there. Her curatorial projects have been presented at different venues, such as the Loft Project Etagi Avant Film Festival, Anthology Film Archives here in New York City, Independent Film Show, Moscow International Film Festival, and again, there's more, so I'm going to stop. She's on the faculty of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Smolny, teaching film and curatorial practice. So welcome, Masha.
Thank you. I'm afraid of microphones.
So I will start with thank you, Sound Cluster, to inviting me to this conference, which is fascinating. I'm very happy and nervous to be here. And before I go to some remarks, I'm going to show you the teaser from a project which I'm going to talk about. Hopefully it will be a teaser for my future film. And it was built on materials which... It's already on. It will be... we collected for this research... where I used the sound. Does it work? Okay. So.
G2545, G3256, G809, G861.
Аладжалова Елена, Абдулаева Нателла, Антипова Евгения, Афонина Таисия, Баланова Клавдия, Балашова Антонина.
Императорская академия художеств была основана в 1757 году. Изначально была задумана Петром Великим по подобию французской для обучения наукам, языкам и искусствам. Пятилетних мальчиков брали на воспитание и обучение, требующее полной изоляции от семьи во имя прекрасного. 20 лет муштры, печного отопления, ледяных колонн и из стен академии выходили, если не боговдохновенные творцы, то отличные ремесленники. Многие не выдерживали подобного обучения искусству, спивались или умирали от болезней, приобретенных в стенах академии.
G2160. G2507.
Вот этот номер.
G2300. G это значит женщина, да?
Вот значит женщина.
G810. Женщины были в академии всегда. Прислуга, любовницы, жены и дочери профессоров. Светские дамы, смотрительницы и вдовы. Но никогда в качестве профессиональных художниц. Только в 1890 году женщинам впервые разрешили сдачу вступительных экзаменов и предоставили возможность профессионального обучения и овладения профессией художника наравне с мужчинами.
Ректор Академии выразил свою позицию весьма ясно. Свой сознательный выбор в пользу традиционного искусства он сделал, поработав в Гугенхайме. Свою роль и роль Академии он видит в первую очередь в презервации традиций реалистической школы, находя прелесть в этом старомодном и консервативном подходе. То же самое Гройс писал о культурной политике сталинского периода. Роль пролетариата состояла не в создании новой культуры, но в апроприации и сохранении классической традиции, деконструированной авангардом 20-х годов. В Академии в роли пролетариата выступают студенты и студентки, заканчивающие в 28 лет, не имеющие критического аппарата и слов для своей работы. Они только выучили, что нужно сохранять традиции и русскость. Обреченные мастерски владея техникой, служить малярами чужих идей.
Ирина.
Бызова Злата. Вылинская Лапина Римма. Васильева Валентина.
Феминистская история искусства. В 60-е и 70-е годы прошлого столетия проблематизировала вопрос участия и положения женщины-художника в мире искусства. Гегемония мужчины-творца была поставлена под вопрос, а феминистские авторы выявили вполне конкретные факторы, исключающие женщин из истории искусства или категоризирующие их творчество как вторичное, а значит, недостойное для включения в историю. В своей программной статье 1971 года «Почему не было великих женщин-художниц» Линда Нохлин выводит несколько причин этого отсутствия. Одной из них являлось структурное ограничение, барьеры, с которыми сталкивалась женщина, поступившие в арт-институции. Сегодня нет серьезных институциональных ограничений. Большинство нынешних студентов Академии художеств – девушки. Однако структурные барьеры замкнутой системы, сложившаяся властная иерархия, отсутствие рефлексии и саморефлексии, психологическое давление, с которыми сталкиваются жители Академии и с которыми столкнулись мы, как пришедшие извне, воздействуют гораздо сильнее, чем видимые физические препятствия.
Мочнёва Римма, Меньшикова Нина, Мещанинова Антонина. Почему же нет великих русских художниц? Почему так мало художниц, вышедших из стен Академии? В чем причина этого отсутствия? Наш фильм – попытка вступить в непосредственное взаимодействие с системой, расколдовывание которой позволит создать свободное пространство для интерпретации. Чеснокова Александра, Чарбадзе Лариса, Эренбург Зинаида, Юнович София, Яхьяева Матлюба.
Sorry for the technical. I see. Okay, perfect. All right. So
This project was created and carried out as a feminist collective art research, bringing together a visual artist, me, and two student curators from a program curatorial studies at Smolny University, Yana Mikhailina and Yaroslav Volovod. From the beginning, it was conceived as an interdisciplinary project which combined several spheres: artistic research, sociology of art, visual sociology, art history, and curatorial studies. And from the beginning, I knew that I will use sound as a subversive element to disenchant the conservative environment of museum and academy. I will use video to capture the social interactions, and from this material, I would extract sound components, so to call to do the conscious noise occupation. During 4 months, we have immersed ourselves into intensive research collecting data for the exhibition. I have to say, the data in front of you, but I have to say that the participants in the academy didn't take us seriously carrying on with their arrogance towards contemporary art and its practitioners. I have to say that there is there is a huge gap between classical art tradition and contemporary art in Russia at the moment. The participants of the project were very open, is giving out information, talks, thoughts, views, because they didn't expect us to produce anything significant or serious, needless to say, anything critical. By the end of the project, when they saw the results, many of them were quite surprised. For some of the participants, the project became an empowerment trigger to question social reality they live in and try to change it. At the beginning, our project had several research questions and aims. St. Petersburg Academy of Fine Arts brings together under one roof the museum, the Russian Academy of Fine Art Museum, educational space, St. Petersburg Repin Institute of Painting, Sculpture, and Architecture, and Library of Russian Academy of Arts. All the internal structures of Academy is androcentric. Museum collection consists of mostly male names, and faculty is predominantly male, especially in practical classes. However, for the last 10, 15 years, most of the students are female, devoting 6 years of their life studying practical arts and hear during this time exclusively male voices. Men talk about art, criticize their work, nurture them, and broadcast sometimes very conservative and patriarchal views and opinions. So our first intention was to see what's happening with these young female artists-to-be and learn how the education affects them. During the course of the research, we had more questions, many of which were remained unanswered. The project's format was a contemporary art exhibition built into the conservative body of a traditional museum. The exhibition brought together several elements: audio installation, video installation, and exhibition of paintings. Our small audio speakers, total of 16, were dispersed in the entire space of a museum. A museum visitor could hear compound narratives, the material for which was taken from the video interviews with the project informants, as well as the ambient sounds of spaces, audio artifacts of interactions, personal direct statements, and self-reflections taken from our research logs and diaries. They were grouped together around certain themes and categories, for example, traditional art versus contemporary art, gender, roles of men and women in the society, motherhood and art making, female destiny, Soviet history and art educational system, conservative backlash. The corresponding cards with these categories were placed near each speaker. In our view, the omnipresent sound burst into the silent space of a museum, transforms the visual experience of a viewer, and fills it with additional meanings. The viewer has to come closer to the speaker in order to hear its whispering sound, thus automatically cutting short the distance between her, himself, and the artwork near which the speaker is placed. Standing there and listening, he has a chance to see the painting in details while diving into personal narratives of others. And I have to say, the speakers did not have an amplifier, so you really had to come closer. This audio narrative presents what is usually hidden from a wider audience: the process of artistic creation, the social structure of traditional art world, its views and goals, educational strategies of art students, professional opportunities for young artists, females and males, barriers and contradictions, psychological pressure which we face, and others. The narratives were long, around 30 minutes each, and it was an important gesture for me as a feminist artist and researcher. First of all, you cannot cut short the stories of others. You let them speak as long as they needed to express their idea. Secondly, I wanted to address the issue of duration in viewing of contemporary artwork, which demands time and effort as any classical painting. Central work of exhibition was three-channel video installation aimed at the ceiling. Silent video projections consist of visual documentation of our impressions of space and environment. It was non-narrative and very expressive with its editing style, a homage to experimental film tradition. It is needed to say my co-workers didn't have any shooting skills when they started the project. I gave several tech workshops to teach them how to shoot and explain general logic of video documentation. So the material we all gathered was quite unprofessional, but it was also a document of a learning process of others within the project. In addition, there was a certain subversive gesture in capturing and documenting so highly professionalized environment as classical art school by people who had been just learning visual methods. Another gesture, aiming the projection to the ceiling and rejecting any comfortable sitting, was a direct commentary to the position of video art in the hierarchy of art forms. Needless to say, that as a moving image practitioner, I was not considered a true artist by the academics and people inhabiting academy. I cannot draw or paint. As in case with the works of high art, for example, ceiling decorations in churches or cathedrals or Raphael loggias in the Hermitage, we ask the viewer to change his usual visual experience of viewing moving images and to look up at the video dome. Through the appropriation of this form of representation, a sacred, classic, referential, archaic, and its digital intrusion into the academic space, we insisted on the canonization of video form, which is traditionally considered to be low art. The video projection was accompanied by the separate sound, a list of the female artists who were or have been in contact with the academy as a student, and you hear part of this audio in a film. With this gesture, we want to pay a tribute to women artists who for some time studied, worked at the walls of the academy, and then went out in the professional field of art. Many of them are not well known. Most of them have sunk into the streams of history. Thus, by adding women into the art history, we insisted on legitimation of a feminist discourse in the context of art institutions and brought attention to the position of female artists and educators within conservative education surroundings in Russia. The final element of the project was an exhibition of 11 paintings by 10 female artists, which were selected from the museum collection. Some of these works were exhibited for the first time. We showed the diversity within realist Soviet school, that is also a gray and badly researched area in the Russian art history. In contrast to the academic sociological research, an art project might not provide answers and might not put forward hypotheses. Although I did make some theoretical conclusions from our project, in general, I think the aim of the art to pose questions, provoking experts, in our case, art historians, critics, curators, sociologists, as well as general public, for further investigation and inquiries, creating a foundation for critical dialogue and reflections. Thank you.
Thank you, Masha. We're just going to slide the laptop over here. Our third presenter is Olga Tulumi, who teaches here in the art history program at Bard. She's an architectural historian, and she writes on the acoustic spaces of war rooms, courtrooms, assembly halls, and other interiors where the imagination of a global space has been articulated during the 20th century. She looks a lot at UN buildings, too, which I have a particular interest in. Her book, In Progress, examines new forms of governmentality at the design of international institutions during the first half of the 20th century. Her writing has appeared at the Journal of the Society for Architectural Historians, Buildings and Landscapes, Cultural Machine, and Thresholds. In 2015, she co-organized the panel Sound Modernities, Architecture, Technology, and Media. She holds a PhD from Harvard and a Master's of Science degree from MIT and an architecture degree from the university in Athens.
Aristotle, sorry,
I abbreviated with an A, which was a mistake.
Aristotle.
Yes, exactly.
Center, wrong move.
So I'm going to slide this over to you.
All right, okay. So hi for me as well.
That's not usually my voice, but that will be my voice today. So I will be talking about transmission from the perspective of an architectural historian. Given that most architectural scholarship addressing sound focuses on concert halls and auditoriums and the question of reverberation, my presentation in a panel on transmission and its relationship to sound might seem out of place, to say the least. What I will be talking about today concerns these technologies of transmission that Brian also mentioned earlier, and a particular kind of transmission that, however, I believe brings together and cross-contaminates our understanding of humans and machines within informational networks. And I will be pointing to a question that I find particularly productive, that is the question of intelligibility, the potential of a message to be comprehended and understood, which potentially, I think, complicates our understanding of transmission and noise or even infrastructures at large. So today we'll be giving you a very, very rough outline of the premise of my book in progress, and then I will focus on spaces where new knowledge about transmission was produced, interior spaces, and the possibility to speak about transmission. So my current work examines the emergence of a global space, quote-unquote, in the intersection of institutional models of global organization and the rise of communication technologies. Following Mark Mazower in his argument that during the beginning of the 20th century, a new institutional model of global governance came to replace previous imperial models, I ask how was transmission reinscribed within these institutional spaces and what kind of internationalism did it make possible? In broad strokes, I argue that historical spaces such as the Nuremberg Trials, Courtroom, the UN General Assembly Hall, spaces that bring forth the paradoxical nature of institutional internationalism, reaching inward so as to reach out, radically excluding from the world in order to connect it, produce new ideas of global citizenship and redefine the public sphere. So, or notions of the public sphere, to be more precise. So urban historians and geographers have addressed the topic of transmission from a geopolitical perspective, as those technological infrastructures where territoriality and sovereignty, along with their systemic asymmetries, are negotiated or reaffirmed. However, architectural historians tend to be more ambivalent about the position of those technological vernaculars within architectural discourse. Architectures of transmission seem to radically undo what the discipline has come to stand for: eponymous architecture, aesthetic inquiry, and intentional form. And this is not to say that there is no aesthetical inquiry in these technological vernaculars, but it's another topic. The only histories that account for transmission either fetishize the instances networks become visible to the public in their monumental form, as with communication towers, or interrogate the use of the network as a metaphor and a scheme that architects appropriate as part of their own visual language, right? So there is nothing sonic there in a way. Most of the times, these accounts focus on the exterior form and interrogate the representational function of these objects, reinforcing the place of the visible within the historical record and dooming the invisible to the lived, the invisible and the lived, in my opinion, to oblivion. So I ask what happens when we resituate within the historical record the invisible, and as I will show today, quite literally the inaudible part of the technologies of transmission. So take, for example, and this will be my first example, anechoic chambers. Here. Only 30 seconds of this. Oh, no. We went to another YouTube video.
More.
There was a disaster. Now we have to watch the advertisement. That's a problem. Oh, you cannot do that. You don't control that screen.
Sponsored by Minimate.
All right,
now the cat's out of the bag.
Saturday comes slow. Do you love me? Do you love me? Is there nothing there? In the limestone caves, in the southwest land, what sounds in the kingdom, beneath us on the sand? Saturday comes slow. Do you love me? Do you love me?
If you look at the ear has an amazing...
I have like only 30 seconds for that. So what you just watched, and apart from the advertisements, which I didn't intend for, is a promo film from Massive Attack's 2010 campaign against music torture. And here a nod to Greg Moynihan, who is working on an article on music torture. Featuring a former Guantanamo Bay detainee against the background of an anechoic chamber. At first, this directorial choice to place a video campaigning against loudness, another note to Jonathan, in Stern, inside of a space of silence seems contradictory. However, what I want to argue is that more than a place of silence, anechoic chambers stand for sites of intelligibility. And what is at stake here is the intelligibility of the detainee's message. So, for those of you who don't know, and I can go to my PowerPoint. Anechoic chambers are spaces with no reverberation, no echo, that's the result of it, described often in the popular press as quote-unquote fearful spaces where the world, quote-unquote, goes strangely dead and people speak with lifeless voices, which is the result of the reverberation that tends to reaffirm the presence of one body, right? So during World War II, these were the spaces where transmission became the subject matter of interdisciplinary inquiry, and there are many accounts of that. Psychologists, acousticians, and engineers at Harvard's Psychoacoustic and Electroacoustic Laboratory would assemble inside them conscientious objectors and machines, humans and non-humans, to test their articulation, their ability to render messages intelligible at the end of the communication system. So in order to do so, the two laboratories invested time, public funds, and personnel in developing standards for optimal transmissions where humans and machines could intelligibly talk to one another, right? So my question then becomes, what can we learn by looking and possibly listening to these laboratories and their architecture? So this is a plan from some archival research, right? So although the photograph misleadingly establishes anechoic chambers as autonomous islands of isolation, the plan soon reveals their existence within an infrastructure of AC units and control rooms and storage facilities. So the thick walls of wedges, the acoustical stalagmites and stalactites, as Leo L. Baranek described them, establish a double acoustic seal from both sound traveling outward and sound traveling inward. They separate radically the site of experimentation from the infrastructure, be it human or technological, that supports it. The user is both visually and acoustically detached from the place that makes this transmission possible, and at the same time, he or she is reconstituted for the engineer and the scientist inside the control room as an abstraction inhabiting charts and statistical tables. In other words, the subject exists as separate yet connected part of the communication system, not aware of the entirety of the infrastructure at place, yet informing it. So what does happen then when these asymmetries established within a laboratory space move outside the laboratory? So as Paul Edwards has argued, these were models that established a closed world, right? In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the same acousticians that worked on the anechoic chamber, I'll actually stay in this slide for a minute, namely Leo L. Baranek, whose laboratory, BBNN, constituted a vital component of another major informational network, which some of you might know, the ARPANET, a predecessor to the internet, consulted on the design of the UN General Assembly Hall, the interior to establish not only how a space for global governance should look like, but also sound like. So the voice of the world, and here I want you to compare the two images before the seal was placed and after the seal was placed. The voice of the world projected from a loudspeaker cage behind the UN seal did not have to resonate with the public, but rather to be transmitted. When given the task, Beranek and his team at BBNN did not turn to auditoriums, but rather to anechoic chambers for an acoustical operative model. What they appropriated was the principle and not the form. The UN General Assembly Hall could sound like an anechoic chamber, but could not look like one. So, however, then the question becomes, which are the implications of these closed world models when they come to shape and enable open world models, at least in their aspiration? And these were moments, the UN to start with, but also its continuing legacy in other interiors, such as the European Court for Human Rights, where the signature acoustic environment of the anechoic chamber informed and shaped interiors for global governance. So I would like to close with a point or suggestion, since I'm still working through this material in the position of anechoic chambers within this larger history of interiors of global governance. I would like to end with maybe a suggestion or a point that maybe in studying or including this kind of history of the built environment as both a lived space, place, a lived practice, and a historical and social and political construct, we can find new ways to address sound as an infrastructure, basically, beyond that exists beyond the technological realm. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Olga. Our final presenter this afternoon is Professor Tom Porcello, who comes to us from the anthropology program at Vassar College, just a little bit south of here. He has been both director of the media studies program there and the co-director of the media studies development project there. He is trained in linguistic anthropology and ethnomusicology and has done extensive work in sound recording studios on technological and discursive practices involved in popular music production. He co-edited a book in 2006 titled Wired for Sound, Engineering and Technologies in Sonic Cultures, which I highly recommend. He was awarded, that book was awarded a prize by the Society of Ethnomusicology, and his work has appeared in several journals, including Social Studies of Science, Ethnomusicology, Popular Music, and Current Musicology. Recently, he's begun work on a recording project that will highlight similarities and differences between live and recorded sounds in American sports, baseball and football, and he's going to talk to us about that today. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you. I'm really mindful of keeping enough time for Q&A, so I'm going to try to move quickly. I want, before I start, to give a really quick shout-out, because I think this might be of interest to some of you. Vassar is in the second of 3 years of a major grant from the Mellon Foundation called Creative Arts Across Disciplines. We organized the 3 years of the grant to focus on the senses, and this year the sense that we've been focusing on is hearing or sound. We have a number of visiting artists and curricular initiatives as part of it. This coming week, we have two sonic cyborgs on campus for a public event on Wednesday. And as Maria knows, because she's bringing her sonic geographies class to it.
Mine.
And yours, yes. Sorry. to a concert that is part of a course that is being team taught by a physicist, our choir director, and an art historian, where they've been going to different performance spaces on the Vassar campus, making recordings of them. It's going to become a form of a composition that will play out over all of those spaces the evening of May 5th. You would need to get in contact with the grant because it is a ticketed event, and you can find how to do that if you simply go to your browser and type in Creative Arts Vassar. Maybe you need to add the word disciplines, I don't know, but you'll get to the link from there. What I want to talk about today is going to harken back in some ways to some things that Jonathan Stern raised in his talk yesterday. In 2007, I decided that I never wanted to write another word about recording studios ever again in my life. And it happened to coincide with a year that I was organizing a driving trip from the East Coast to the West Coast with my, I guess he was 11 or 12-year-old at that point, son, who is a huge baseball fan. And so, of course, he organized the trip by figuring out where there were home games and hitting various cities. And halfway through the trip, I found myself really amazed at what I was hearing in baseball stadiums and how different they were as we went from city to city. And then I found myself really amazed that I was amazed about it. And I started to ask myself, why was I operating under the assumption that I was just going to hear the same thing in every single place? And I think the short answer to that is because for most people who consume professional sports, at least in the United States, you consume it through the media. You consume it through radio, through television, through the internet, and increasingly for younger people, through video games. So these are always experiences that would fall in one way or another, I think, under the rubric of transmission. In lunch today with Danielle, we decided that I was going to redo my presentation a little bit to actually begin with an interview that is now several years old, in which I talked a little bit about the origins of that particular project. And then I want to turn to talking, in what time I have left, about crowd noise. But first, a little bit about the baseball project. You can listen to it. You don't need to watch it. It's just me.
So, Tom, you describe yourself as an anthropologist of sound. What does that mean?
Well, generally, anthropologists think of themselves as studying culture, studying language, studying music. I like to study all auditory phenomena, not make rigid distinctions between things that are music and things that are language and things that are naturally occurring sound, but to understand the way that all kinds of sound affect what it means to live in the world. I've been doing research recently on baseball stadiums, and I'm incredibly interested in the ways that everything from musical selections to the architecture and the acoustics of stadiums affects what it's like to go attend a baseball game. Yeah, so in traveling around the country, one of the things that I find really fascinating is how going to ball games gives you a little mini portrait of all of the different ways of speaking, whether you're talking regionally around the country or whether you're talking working class speech versus upper middle class speech in any particular place that you go to. Another thing that's really different is baseball stadiums are not all built to the same plan. Fields are, you know, the outfields can be larger in some places than in others. Stands are closer or further away from the field. So actually what it's like to sit at any given place in a ballpark, say, you know, by the first base seats, may be really different in terms of what you hear from the field, what you hear from the stands, if you're in Detroit as opposed to Chicago, as opposed to Los Angeles. The project came about completely by accident. I was driving with my son from the East Coast to the West Coast to go visit my father a few years ago. My son plays a lot of baseball. He's a huge baseball fan, so we just decided to organize the trip by where are there ballparks along the way, and we stopped there. We saw some ball games. I had been thinking, we'll take a lot of pictures, we'll make an iPhoto slideshow, something like that, and instead of putting music under it, I thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I had sounds from all the ballparks to mix into the slideshow? So I took along a mini disc recorder, a stereo mic, just started recording randomly at all the games that we went to. And as I was listening to them, I began to notice a bunch of these sonic differences that I was talking about. Never expected to run into them, but as soon as I started hearing them, I thought, there's a bigger research project here.
All right, so basically I'd said all that in the introduction. Sorry. Let me see if I can quickly mirror my displays here, because I do... All right, so what I'd intended to talk about today, rather than the baseball stuff, so let me get into it quickly, was to talk about crowd noise at American football games. And what I want to talk, what I want to try to get at a little bit is to poke at the sometimes contradictory stance taken on noise in competition, where depending upon the specific acoustic artifact involved or the context in which it occurs, it could either be valued or it could be censored. And I think part of what I'm trying to get at here with the use of the term noise is the way that Dave Novak has referred to it in the Keywords on Sound book as essentially a kind of, he says it's not a sound. Well, he says it is a sound, but more than that, it's also a meta discourse about sound and its social signification and its social interpretation. So to try to illustrate that a little bit, I think everybody's aware of the concept of the so-called home field advantage that, you know, home teams are said to have in athletic competition. And the home field advantage is about a lot of things. It's about being able to sleep in one's own bed instead of a hotel, about not being jet-lagged from travel from the East Coast to the West Coast or wherever it is, about getting a nicer locker room because home locker rooms are always nicer than the visiting team's locker rooms. But one of the things that it is routinely considered to be about is having the crowd on your side. cheering the home team in appreciation or for motivation, booing and heckling the opponent. So in other words, the home field advantage is definitely a sonic phenomenon. And it is, I think, also a sanctioned sonic practice by spectators. So I'm going to show a couple of clips here. The first one is from... There's some strange things going on. Okay, the first one is from the 1987 Rose Bowl football game, which featured the University of Michigan playing Arizona State University. It's a New Year's Day, end of season bowl. It's played in Pasadena, California. And so in a lot of ways, it was essentially a home game for the Arizona State fans because of the proximity to Phoenix. And what we're going to see is a clip in which play was stopped due to excessive crowd noise by the Arizona State fans. I'll play about a minute of it. So that's Michigan in white trying to start the play.
And the noise from a predominantly partisan Arizona State crowd. They have an estimated 40,000, but I would guess more than that here compared to what looks to be about 10,000 Michigan fans.
Have we ever, and this is our eighth Rose Bowl game, seen them have to stop play on the field for crowd noise? I don't think we have, Dick.
When you look at the yellow pom-poms, they stretch from one end zone across the far side all the way to the other end zone. That's almost all Sun Devil territory. Now, in college ball, that quarterback can take, in the words of the officials, forever if he wants.
As we look at all of those yellow pom-poms being waved, I'll bet there are some real stories out there about how people went about trying to get tickets for this game, because you got to know that the Arizona State people say they could have sold this whole stadium out.
Apparently at Wisconsin, they delayed the game almost a half an hour before Michigan finally engineered a play. Now they tone down. And with a score of 15-6, 5.5 minutes left in the first half. Harbaugh still reluctant.
Okay, I'll stop it there. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, obviously, including the way that noise is being talked about as part of the broadcast. The fact that there is no time limit for the quarterback to hike the ball, and so if the noise became a problem, you could just essentially stall the game, delay the game, stop the game, whatever the case may be. One thing I do want to point to, and this harkens back directly to Jonathan Stern's talk yesterday, I've been a full-time administrator for 8 years, so I'm really not up on a lot of literature at this point. The Heller piece that you were speaking about yesterday is not one I was aware of, but I think in this clip you can see the concepts of noise occupation very, very clearly in the stadium. Maybe not so much seeing listener collapse, but I have another clip in which you will absolutely see that. But also the sort of imagined loudness, which is a broadcast artifact at this point. I mean, you know you're in a super loud space, or at least it's being engineered so that it sounds like a very loud space. It's being talked about as a very loud space. And so even though we're not listening to it at a very loud volume, I think that that, you know, notion of the imagined loudness is very much at play in the media object. Okay, so I want to show just another quick clip that also involves Arizona State. This was a home game. This is a much shorter clip. Here they are playing, I believe, the University of Southern California. Whoops, I don't want to do that. And I'm just going to let the commentators explain this one.
Touchdown toss from Otten to Miller, another from Otten to Allred, and listen to the crowd roar. Otten wants to talk to the referee about it. Well, he's been talking to him all day, and the guy hasn't given him any help.
He's saying, I'll go over and talk to him.
Announcer. Make the announcement on the crowd noise.
Attention, please. Here's an appointment. Rules make it mandatory that the offensive team must be able to hear its signals. We request your cooperation and courtesy in this matter. Further noise infractions will result in a charge timeout to the defensive team or see
I think they can get Arizona State for inciting the crowd. You see that safety man?
Okay, so what you heard there was the public address announcer coming on to inform the crowd that if they continued to be too loud as a home field crowd, that there would be a penalty against their own team imposed. Okay, so again, we can talk about the significance of all of that, but I think it's relatively clear. I do want to make just a couple of points here. Obviously, communicative imperative is what's at play in these two clips. The offenses can't make the verbal signals that they want to make because the home crowd noise with the home team on defense is preventing a transmission of information, or there's a lack of intelligibility, of course, would be another way to think about that, playing out very clearly. The rules in college football have changed over the years since these clips were made. There's now a play clock so that a quarterback can't walk away forever from a play and endlessly delay the game. I think what I want to do at this point is just go to the third clip that I was going to play, and it harkens back to, this was referred to, I believe, again, I think, in Jonathan's talk yesterday, about the so-called 12th man at the Seattle Sonics NFL games. There's a really interesting history behind the whole concept of the 12th man. It's very important to recognize at this point that it is a thoroughly commodified concept. But there sort of became a bit of a war between two of the professional NFL teams, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Seattle Seahawks, about who had the louder stadium. And so they both ran these kind of contests where they brought out, you know, sound pressure level meters and got their fans really, really super excited, and who could create the greatest number of decibels. And after going back and forth between the two cities, Seattle at least claims that it should win the contest. You can watch this, and I think you can spend a fair amount of time thinking about listener collapse as well as crowd noise in this particular clip. This is noise is something quite literally to celebrate in this case. So I just want to end quickly with an observation. Clearly there's this tension between everything that's great about a lot of noise in these sporting events and problems that arise, or you know, the difficulties of noise. It's this two-edged sword in a sense, positive and negative valences. Jonathan mentioned quickly yesterday the Atlanta Falcons football team, which was fined in March of 2015, $350,000, and it lost some draft picks in the upcoming selection of college players for the following year as a result of having piped crowd noise, artificial crowd noise, into their stadium. And the NFL basically said, no, you know, you're going to be penalized for using unreal crowd noise. So after that happened, the team owner for the Atlanta Falcons said, quote, "What took place was wrong and nowhere near the standards by which we run our business." I mean, I love this. Just, it's about business, right? "Anytime there are actions that compromise the integrity of the NFL or threaten the culture of our franchise, as this issue did, they will be dealt with swiftly and strongly." So here, you know, now you've got noise moving out into integrity and so forth. And so I just want to end with the observation that noise is not just a strategic intervention situationally linked to specific games and competitive strategy. but it's also the material manifestation for transmitting an ideological stance relating sound to morality in this particular business context. And let's just end there.
Thanks, Tom. Well, thank you to all the panelists for, such great and interesting and varied presentations. And since we have only 10 minutes for questions, I will open it up to the floor immediately. But I do just want to say quickly that, I was hoping this would happen. I feel like, you know, the whole earlier question about the unbridgeable sort of phenomenological versus sort of technical aspects of sound, somehow I feel like we're helping to maybe bridge a little bit more with this question of transmission, because it seems to me that this is all about, you know, we have regimes of knowledge transmission happening here in all these venues, some mostly having to do with buildings and structures, but really about institutions and epistemological regimes that are being sort of constantly brought up. At least that's what I kept hearing in these presentations. And so it makes me feel good that we are doing our part to bring phenomenology and technology a little bit maybe more together in this conversation. So saying that, I see the first hand here. Oh, and Cal has a question too. Do you want to just stand up, maybe?
Sure.
And
Tom, in relation to your sound versus morality and fooling people, I'm on both sides of that. But there are automobiles now, there are vehicles now that, in order to enhance the buyer's experience of being in this car, they pump exhaust systems, engine noises, back in through the speaker systems, regardless of whether the engine is on or not. Are you aware of this?
That I wasn't aware of.
They are.
Okay.
It does exist. It's a lot cheaper than actually dropping out baffles in the muffler systems, which does the same thing without actually improving any car performance. So this is really all about what they were doing at the Falcons, I would imagine. Personally, I have no problem with that. It's all a commodity. You're consuming this thing on television. It gets more exciting. It gives the announcer something to say. It sells soap. That's a different issue. You haven't heard about it, so I can't ask you to comment on it. But I think it's all of that same piece about we have the ability to transmit this thing called an experience, not necessarily sound. I am also in this related business, and I'm all about audio for records and music. We're all about just transmitting that. I see no harm, no foul in that.
Yeah, honestly, I don't have a problem with it either.
I think one of the reasons that people get upset with these kinds of things is because they don't realize to what degree sound is engineered into our lives on a daily basis. So, you know, BMW and Mercedes spend a lot of time engineering the way the door is going to sound when you close the car. When Ford redesigned the Mustang about 10 years ago, they went and they made recordings of the soundtrack from the film Bullet with Steve McQueen, which had Mustang car chases taking place on hills in San Francisco, and they tuned the exhaust to sound the way that it sounded in the movie, not realizing or maybe just ignoring the fact that that itself was a heavily mixed sound, including tiger roars and all other kinds of things that were in it. So to the extent that people are surprised and dismayed by this kind of stuff, I think it's just because, you know, a lack of awareness about how highly engineered our sonic environments are to begin with, or at least I think that's part of the answer.
I was wondering if Drew and Olga and anyone could speak to kind of how the sonic imperialism basically that's going on, whether it's the people trying to liberate themselves or confine cultures, how that relates to these consensually loud environments here, where it's almost like this influx of almost seemingly directionless noise right now in this culture.
And just kind of the structures that permit.
Sounds like a super big question.
I have to first ask a set of questions to you before answering the question, so I'm not sure. And I think Drew is a better person for responding to that.
Well, I would say what I think is really interesting in the Portuguese context is they have to create this destabilization. I mean, all of these sort of European colonial regimes are not operating from nodes of power, right? Mm-hmm. So the sonic is a way of conceivably in which the Portuguese are seeing a threat with the Cold War, are situating themselves and creating Mozambique within another type of geography, which I follow Nancy Rose Hunt's idea is that these imperial regimes are governing from conditions of paranoia, right? So just as the businesses think that they can sell the product not by you looking at it, you don't buy a Mercedes by going to a car dealership, you see it by the engineered sounds, or you support a sports team. I think that these colonial imperial regimes are recognizing, and you can see this in the notes, right? Mm-hmm. That and what is fascinating to me is you have no sound recordings, right? So at one level, Frelimo has co-opted the oral to tell its narrative of liberation, but bureaucrats were sitting and talking about sound and visuality at extensive lengths. And that extension shows that the Portuguese regime was actually very paranoid about this, right? It was didn't see it as a place of power.
I want to pick up on that question. The other thing that seems to run through all the talks on this panel, surely there's transmission, but in every case, transmission is regulated and bureaucratized in one way or another. Yeah. And so, I mean, really, it's maybe more an observation than a question, but if anybody wants to talk about that, I'd love to hear about it.
I can talk about that. That I can talk about, but because I was actually thinking of the Nuremberg Trials courtroom, and I was thinking of this one moment in the previous panel where Brian is like, can everyone listen to me? And everybody says yes, and then the microphone is right in front of him. He's like, why is this happening? Well, it's the record. We need to record it, right? We need to like produce a record of this event. And I was thinking, like, the transmission actually produces this record. In the case of the Nuremberg Trials, was an immense record that was supposed to be the checkpoint of whatever was happening there and whatever decisions were made. But it was so immense and bureaucratic that they never actually went back to it. So the decisions were made without revisiting the record. And the record was actually sonic record. They were making recordings, and they were actually written records. So they had all these other records that were never revisited. They're now housed at the National Archives. So whoever is interested in listening to, I don't know how many hours of the Nuremberg Trials, you can go and listen to the entirety of it. But it's a record that, because it is bureaucratic or because it is this kind of record, it kind of is an unusable record produced by transmission. That's my thought.
These technologies for producing sound are shaping politics. It's not that the politics themselves or the positions of the state are dictating what the sound can do. So based on what they hear, they create a new regulatory bureau to operate that. It's not that they want to do this and then they use sound to do that.
My question is for Masha. I really liked that the speakers transmitting sound were small and at ground level, so it had to be a really intimate experience with the sound, and from a curatorial perspective, that makes a lot of sense to me. From what I could tell from the photographs, the video installations were projected on the ceiling, and I was wondering if you could speak to that decision and the kind of synesthesia that it creates as your mind is drawn to so many different corners of the space while you're experiencing the overarching theme of the exhibition.
Well, that was a different space, so there was no small speakers in this space. You would hear only this listing of names and the codes, and it's talking about the bureaucracy, because what we were interested in taking out the bureaucracy, which is like hidden, and make a sound of it, like listing all the women who were there. And as a matter of fact, it was a first record, like, you know, we Academy was criticized for its conservative, but it's never been criticized for this gender politics. So we went and kind of created these statistics. So it is like a turning the taking a bureaucratic mechanism and turning for our sake, like, you know, basically appropriating. So in this area where the video installation was, there was no small speakers. They were dispersed in this like a half a circle. Exhibition. It's a permanent exhibition of a museum of Art Academy. So you actually make, and as you said, it's a small speakers and it's a whisper. It's not. It's nothing which you can like loudly hear. And in that space, there was just listening. And for the ideally wanted to create that watching, like, you know, ideally want that you have to put your hand up. And as I said, it was, you're not supposed to watch the video, as a matter of fact. You're not supposed to look at it and like, you know, see something in it. It was three channels, not looped. So it was about the gesture and not about the meaning. It's not about the visual pleasure because you're uncomfortable, right? But it's about your senses and about your bodily experience. I wanted people to be tired. I mean, the other organizers asked me, why don't you put some, you know, cushions on the floor? I said, no, I don't want. I don't want people to stay. I want them to move out, actually. And like, you know, physically suffer, as a matter of fact. I'm sorry.
Well, on that note, we actually do have no more time, so we will end on the note of physical discomfort. Thank you to all of our panelists. That was really great. Announcement. Sorry, Cal. We have the oral history workshop now with Suzanne Snyder happening in room 217. And also, we have another sound walk with Todd Shalom. Do we want to meet again outside of in the Beto lobby? Is that okay? So for those of you who are signed up for either of those, make your way over there now. They start... there's coffee, too? Yay! So there's also coffee and probably tea and other things in the lobby right downstairs. So please avail yourselves, and we'll see you back here at 3:30 for Resonance. Thank you.